On today's episode, I am in the safe labour seat of Barnsley South, where I explore how it has never quite recovered from deindustrialisation despite the government's promise to level up. I'll be speaking to Steph Peacock, the current Labour MP, as well as the Bard of Barnsley, Ian McMillan, to chat all things Yorkshire. Our spotlight issue of the week is health, and I'll be speaking to experts about how ill health has taken root in places like Barnsley and how the next government can turn the tide.
If you vote for anything, vote for this, a prioritising of mind and heart. On your ballot paper, your pencilled kiss is for the future. Health's the place to start rebuilding the bodies that time has snapped into pieces. So let's vote for repair, for the shuffling blokes, scarved and flat-capped, women living just this side of despair, for kids whose cries echo off mouldy walls, families dropped into a lifetime that slows ways of moving and thinking. All this appalls me, from my aching head to my hurting toes. Here's a prescription, the sign of the cross on that bit of paper. Show 'em who's boss.
Ian McMillan there with an exclusive Barnsley sonnet, especially for us. Hello, welcome to Pod's Own Country, the politics podcast from the Yorkshire Post. Now, I'm your host, Mason Boycott Owen, the paper's Westminster correspondent. This is the second in our special Battleground Yorkshire series, where I cover 12 seats in 12 weeks to find the story behind the polls ahead of the next election. Today, we are in Barnsley South, the ex-mining community situated in the towns and village around Barnsley proper. It is a safe Labour seat, and unless something miraculous happens on election night, it is set to stay that way. So, why am I here? Well, this seat is interesting, as it is a case study in one of the biggest issues for Labour if it gets into government: health. The question is, how can it improve the lives of people who have voted for them for decades, but arguably have seen little in return, even under the last Labour government? First up, I spoke to Steph Peacock, the current Labour MP who is set to keep her seat this time around. Steph, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Hiya.
So, has Barnsley ever really recovered from the closure of the pits?
The direct answer is no, it hasn't. I mean, Barnsley was built on coal. And if you'd been speaking to my predecessor 30, 40 years ago, they'd have been a miner, and 30,000 of their constituents would have worked either in or in jobs that were dependent on the pit, as you say, very locally, often at the end of their road. And this month we mark 40 years of the miners' strike, where thousands of men went out on strike to defend their industry and ultimately lost their livelihoods. I think coal mining and the pits is still very much part of the town. If you go, you know, I do a lot of school visits, and all of the kids know about coal and they know about the pits, and now it's their granddads that used to go down pit. And so it's still very much part of the culture of the town. But of course, it's not economically dependent on it anymore. And I don't think it has economically recovered from that closure. I mean, The Guardian did a long read a few years ago, which said that Grimethorpe was the poorest town village in the country. And while it had had a lot of investment from the last Labour government, from the council, it still was really, really struggling. And so I think it's not just that economic legacy either. There's still thousands of men who went down the pit, and there were still issues affecting them today. So whether that be miners' health, so we get a lot of constituents getting in touch with us and still the NUM, and that I'm around sort of disability benefits, around compensation, and around the health issues they're having. And we also see, you know, I also do a huge amount on the miners' pension scheme, because I don't think the government should be in the business of profiting from miners' pensions, and they've taken £4.4 billion out of the scheme, and I've been campaigning for a better and fairer deal on that issue.
And what we've seen in terms of government funding, obviously the government's levelling up agenda has been, you know, quite a big deal since 2019, but has that impacted the communities at all?
We've had no levelling up funding in Barnsley East, and I think that's completely unacceptable. I think if you take a step back and look at the concept of levelling up, most people would agree with it. There are areas, for lots of different reasons, historically and more recently, that have fallen behind and that are not doing as well. And we can kind of all agree with the concept of levelling up, but that's not what we've seen through their policy, because by every measure, Barnsley East is deserving of funding and we've missed out time and again. We've currently got a bid in, and again, it's quite a complicated, unnecessary system where the council put the bid in, the MPS to co-sign it. A lot of effort, time, money goes into these bids, and we've been rejected, and we've got one in at the moment for the Elsick Heritage Centre. For anyone who's listening, who's been there, it's a fantastic place. It's got a lot going for it. It's a really, you know, really nice. There's all the space and potential to make it even better, to really expand it. The reason, you know, I believe that the council chose that area is, again, there's a certain set of criteria for where you bid for money, because some residents might say, well, actually, you know, it'd be better spent elsewhere. Again, the government set down a criteria. So the council put together what I think is a really strong bid for Elsicker, and we're still waiting in the last round of levelling up. They still know that's for the culture. That's for the culture department. If you talk to the culture department, they say, well, no, actually, we have an input because there's a cultural element, but actually it is for the Department of Levelling Up, and they're still dragging their feet. And, you know, I sat in the House of Commons a few weeks ago listening to the budget, hearing the Chancellor read out town, city after each other, the majority Conservative areas. And, without doing a detailed analysis, I'd argue mainly wealthier than Barnsley, yet again getting money. And I don't think it's a very fair policy, and I do think it's unacceptable that, you know, we've missed out.
And taking a step back to the last election, to 2019, obviously you came quite close in the seat, or more close than you'd like to have been, to potentially losing your seat to the Brexit Party. Obviously they only ran against Labour MPs last time round. Can you talk us through, you know, what that felt like for, you know, an MP in such a heavily Labour area to be under threat from another party like that?
Well, look, I mean, I think the last election defeat has been well rehearsed. It was Labour's worst defeat for decades, and, you know, completely understand the reasons why people were angry. And without going back into the whole Brexit debate, you know, people were very angry about Brexit and about the fact that it hadn't happened. You know, I respected the result. You know, I resigned from the front bench against a second referendum. You know, I understood people's anger, and it was a very difficult debate. And I think it was, you know, we can appreciate the reasons why Labour effectively let people down and didn't do as well as we should, didn't put the offer forward that we could have or should have. But I think, you know, that a lot of stuff has happened since then, and I think we're in a very different world now. And, you know, we're campaigning hard to be, you know, not just to win seats like mine, but, you know, to win more seats and to hopefully form the next government. We're in absolutely no way complacent about that. You know, we have to do better than 97 just to get a majority of one. So, you know, nobody is in any way complacent.
And in terms of looking forward to the next election, obviously this area has been voting Labour for years and years and years, but hasn't quite seen the tangible benefits of it because, you know, the party's been in opposition. How do you convince voters who've, you know, stuck with the party for years not to abandon them this time round?
Yeah, I mean, look, my focus has always been to represent people to the best of my ability, to work hard for them. You know, we've helped over 20,000 people with casework here in Barnsley. I've led campaigns, you know, on sentences for dangerous driving, on the mine workers' pension scheme, and on various different issues. You know, so I've done that, and I've made hopefully a difference to people's lives. But you can do more in one day in government than you can do in years of opposition. And we haven't had a Labour government, and therefore, you know, despite the hard work of the Labour Party at different levels of government, and we haven't been able to make the change that we want to be able to do, and that's why it is important to vote Labour and you know, and to keep doing that in the hope that actually this time we can get across the line.
Now, Barnsley, much like Yorkshire, has its many quirks and its own mindset, and the key to unpicking and solving problems in a local area, you need to understand how local people think and how they feel. Ian McMillan, one of Yorkshire's best-loved poets, is a local man. Born in Darfield, south of Barnsley, he has grown up around this seat's voters for years and gives us an insight into how they think. Ian, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here.
In your poem, you spoke about the ill health that's in Barnsley. Is this something that you see out and about all the time?
It's true that when they shut the pits, we lost thousands, tens of thousands of jobs that were well paid, unionised. The NCB, for all its faults, wanted to look after the whole person, which is why we got choirs and bands and cricket clubs and football clubs and bowling clubs. And that's been replaced by a kind of atomisation the opposite of collectivism, where it's every person for themselves. So you do get a lot of people on 0 hours contracts. You get a lot of people who are working for delivery firms. And there's not wrong with that. Everybody's got to work. But somehow there should be a way of giving people proper jobs with proper wages, proper opportunities to spend their money in shops that are full of healthy food and perhaps walk back from the shops. It's really difficult, though, because, as you said, this area suffered so much. It's very difficult to fathom for people who aren't from round here how much this area was actually just shut down by the Conservative government in the 80s. You know, and from where I'm sitting, I can see across to where Oulton Main used to be and Grimthorpe used to be, Grimthorpe Colliery. And it's been replaced by a warehouse, by ASOS, which employs thousands of people who walk and bike and get the bus and go in the car. And there is that kind of thing has been returned. They're not a bad employer, but they employ a certain number of people, but it's not replaced the amount of people who lost their jobs when they shut the pits. And I can see people when I go for my walks who haven't worked since the pit shut, partly because they're not well enough, but partly because the jobs weren't there that they wanted. So it is a long, long-term problem. And hopefully whoever gets in government next time will put plenty of money into somehow, I hate the phrase levelling up, but level us up a bit. Because when I go down south, when I go to leafy suburbs of Surrey, I am astonished how well people look. It's like the difference between walking through, I don't know, Wurzel Gummidge and Baywatch. You know, there's all these people who look really fit and healthy, which you don't often see. You still see them, you see them. But you know what I mean? Somehow we need to realise that we need a lot of help round here. And hopefully, when we get a new government, they will be helping us out, because we definitely need it.
And obviously there's a difference between Barnsley proper, you know, Barnsley the town centre, and the towns and villages around it. You know, I've been back to Barnsley and I've seen, you know, the improvements there. But in your view, has that kind of thing extended out into the other areas?
The middle of Barnsley is looking fantastic. And taxi drivers and shop workers are saying to me, it's great here now. The middle of Barnsley is doing very well. They said things like, you get people coming for a night out from Leeds and from Sheffield, which never happened before. People went out of that. What we need to look at is the villages around Barnsley, which are still struggling. And I think a lot of people in 2019 fell for the lie of the aforementioned levelling up and the idea that somehow, if you voted Tory, that they would look after the people around here, which always struck me as a bit odd. It's like voting against your own best interests. But you know, that's just me, that's a party political point. But I think I'm glad that in the 2019 election both Barnsley Central and Barnsley East voted Labour. But there was around here, as we know, as you know, so many seats that went Conservative because they felt that maybe after a number of years that they hadn't got, I don't know, they hadn't got what they wanted from Labour, and they somehow thought that the Conservatives would give it to them. It will be very interesting to see what happens whenever the next election is. But I would say, you know, that in terms of local and regional government, through Oliver Coppard at South Yorkshire and through our local council in Barnsley, they're doing a great job in the middle of Barnsley, and we just need now to work on the outskirts of Barnsley. They've got this thing called the principal towns, where they're putting money into them. But as we know, as people keep telling us, there's not much money about. But hopefully, one day there'll be a bit more.
And obviously, Boris Johnson tapped into a certain level of support in the north. But Yorkshire always has felt a little bit separate from that, a little bit more unique. But how do the main parties really, you know, focus in on, you know, appealing to that Yorkshire mindset? What is the thing that, you know, binds the rest of the region together?
I think, as we know, there's not just one Yorkshire. Yorkshire is a very nuanced place. So Richmond is different to Rotherham, and Harrogate is different to Halifax. And so somehow what does unite all Yorkshire people is that wonderful Yorkshire word brussenness, with a bit brussen, which means, it's one of those words that's hard to translate or define, but it means a kind of oppositional quality, a kind of taking people at face value, but then weighing up what they say. And so what I think they need to appeal to us, as Tony Harrison, the great Leeds poet, called us, U-Z, they have to be, politicians have to be honest. They have to tell us about the problems. They have to not promise us too much, but maybe in the long term, let us see that we have their interests, that they have our interests at heart, and that we should stop talking about how long it takes us to get to London, but think about how long it takes us to get, you know, if it takes me to get to Grindthorpe on the bus, or it takes me to get to Thurnscoe on the bus. We need to start thinking about that. We need to start thinking about how this part of the world can be more connected. And the trouble is, as you know, that, you know, Yorkshire people are quite tribal, not only about Yorkshire, because it's Britain's Texas, everything's always better and bigger and flashier here, but also it has these tribes within tribes, so that when my team, Barnsley, play a team from Lancashire, we all shout Yorkshire, Yorkshire. But if Barnsley play Huddersfield, we all shout South Yorkshire, and they shout West Yorkshire. So somehow people have to understand the complexity and nuance of Yorkshire. Yes, I think they should try that.
Now, onto our spotlight issue of the week, health. Not to be too blunt, but Barnsley is very unwell. Analysis by the Yorkshire Post makes grim reading when comparing it to other seats in the region. Barnsley South has the highest proportion of people who are disabled, people who are in bad health, very bad health, not working due to sickness, and the estimated highest rate of obesity in Yorkshire. In order to understand how we got to this point, I caught up with Dr. Luke Mumford, a senior lecturer in health economics at the University of Manchester. Luke, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mason.
So how have these issues of, you know, ill health come about in Barnsley? Because you'd assume that these kind of really entrenched issues don't come about overnight.
No, you're exactly right. And I think we need to start by remembering that health inequalities aren't a new phenomenon. They've been around for a very long time. I think the worrying thing about the last few years, particularly the last decade or so, is that the fact that these inequalities or inequities, these sort of unfair and unjust differences in people's health and life outcomes, have been getting a lot wider. And you can trace a lot of this back to things like deindustrialization. So there is a lack of jobs for people to go into, the lack of opportunities. Education has also deteriorated in certain parts of the country. And if you map all of these hotspots out, or fewer jobs, less education opportunities, worse health, more deprivation and poverty, they almost perfectly coincide. Now, as I said, a lot of this has existed for a very long time, but the factors that have made it really get worse over the past sort of 20, 30, even 50 years include things, as I mentioned, deindustrialization, austerity has been really detrimental on people's health and opportunities. And again, there's a lot of research that this has now been proved to feed through into people's health. So if you increase poverty rates, then that leads to worse health outcomes, because people don't have the material wealth and opportunities to afford to have a healthy lifestyle, which then leads to preventable mortality. But as you mentioned, it's not just length of life, it's quality of life. So if you look at measures like healthy life expectancy or disability-free life expectancy, the inequalities in these are even more stark. So people are living in some parts of the north of England and Barnsley and South Yorkshire as few as 51 years in good health. And that's sort of staggering, really, when you think about the pension age is currently 65, 66, being planned to go up to 71. A healthy life expectancy 20 years less than the pension age is incredibly sort of stark and a real sort of sorry indictment on the state of health at the moment in the country, but particularly in certain parts of the country, including Barnsley.
But when we look at things such as the spending and the funding that areas get, I think Barnsley receives the highest per capita funding of any area in Yorkshire in terms of health spending. So what's the solution to this? Is it just a case of more money on top of that, or are there other things that governments can look at?
So there are two points, I think, that are important here. One is that per capita, Barnsley might have more spending in the CCG, or the Clinical Commissioning Group. But if you then adjust that for the needs of the population, it will have much less than other parts of the country. In, for example, even North Yorkshire, which has a much more healthy, affluent population, they might get less per capita. But if you adjust that for the underlying needs of the population, they'll get much more per needs adjusting. And then secondly, the NHS is a brilliant organisation, but it is basically the last port, if you like. It's the thing where we go when we're ill. And it's actually public health that can do a lot of good in this space. If you can keep people healthy and out of hospitals in the first place, then the NHS becomes more effective because it can treat the things that it was designed to treat. So if you think about interventions like public health, population health, these are typically administered by local authorities or local councils. And again, linking this back to policies, particularly austerity, the councils who had the highest health needs saw, on average, the much larger reductions to their budgets from central government. And in times of austerity, when councils are having their purses pinched, the easiest thing to get rid of is public health, because it's the thing that it's not always most popular policies. People don't see that they're investing in the health now for future benefits, and councils are cash strapped. And these type of funding are the first to go. But the in terms of other preventative things as well, things like libraries, community centres, where people can go, feel like they belong to their community, engage with their friends, have a chat and natter, speak to other people who might be experiencing the same things. Those facilities go as well, and we've seen loneliness massively increase, and loneliness is a really strong social determinant of health. So people who feel lonely and isolated are much more likely to present in general practice. They're much more likely to have premature mortality. So all of these things sort of interact. So whilst the NHS might get more per capita, if we do more proactively, that will make a difference. And as I said, if we take into account the underlying need, that will also show that Barnsley gets much less money than it actually needs to treat the fact that it's got a much more unhealthy population than other parts of Yorkshire, but also other parts of the country as well.
And what effect has the pandemic had on places like Barnsley? Obviously, you know, things are bad, but has the pandemic made things even worse than they were already in terms of these health inequalities? Or is it just a case of, you know, we just don't know yet, because I guess it comes back to that point of, you know, there's no point in history that's more remote than the recent past, because we just don't have the distance to look back at it to see the effects.
Yeah, so a really interesting point. I think the pandemic shone a really much needed light on some of these health inequalities. So if you think about some of the things that the pandemic really severely affected, so people's health, for example, but then the underlying causes of those health, so respiratory conditions are always much higher in places like Barnsley and other parts of the country who've historically had lower life expectancy. And again, because of the fact that people's health was already much lower in these communities, meant they were much more vulnerable and susceptible to the effects of the pandemic. We know that people are much more likely to live in multi-occupancy houses in certain communities. And again, Barnsley is one of these. So people are interacting much more than they were, and the pandemic was easily transmitted in these environments. But it's interesting you made the point about history. So if you have a look at a heat map of the 1919 Spanish flu pandemic and compare that with a heat map of mortality from the COVID-19 pandemic, they are scarily similar. So Barnsley was really badly affected by the 1919 pandemic and again by the coronavirus pandemic. And we learned from that communities like Barnsley took much longer to recover. And again, we've seen some evidence that that's the case from the COVID-19 pandemic as well, because health was so badly affected and it was already at really low levels. So there was very little resilience, for want of a better word, to absorb this shock like some other constituencies, some other parts of the country being able to do. That then leads to a much longer scarring effect in these communities, because people have been so badly affected both in terms of health, but also in terms of social and economic outcomes. So we saw unemployment rates rise much steeper in the pandemic in Barnsley. And again, they have not recovered to pre-pandemic levels, or they've been much more sticky than in other parts of the country. And as I mentioned before, lockdowns and loneliness are really important because they really affect people's mental health. People weren't able to socialise, weren't able to see their friends and family. And again, we begin to see some evidence that it has had a much more detrimental effect in certain communities, particularly communities with high levels of deprivation, poverty, and the communities are really struggling to recover from that. And again, coupled with the fact that councils are under so much pressure, the infrastructure that people used to go to for these social interactions, again, community centres, are being closed, that the infrastructure is no longer there. So I think there will be a long-lasting scar, but it will not be equally felt across the country, and the data is beginning to bring this out. We've already seen high levels of recovery in certain parts of the country than we are in others.
Issues like this clearly need a drastic overhaul of health services in the community and in the NHS. The King's Fund, a health think tank, has been looking at what levers the main parties can pull when in government to make a real difference. Earlier, I spoke to their senior policy lead, Toby Brown, to find out more. Toby, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are the main barriers that we're seeing to, you know, solving issues like this with, you know, really entrenched health inequalities across the UK?
Yeah, well, when people talk about health inequalities, they're talking about the kind of avoidable differences between health that exists because of where you live in England or your socioeconomic group or your ethnicity, maybe. And the kind of factors at play around that are, I would say, about threefold, I would summarise. One is like just the general access to treatment of healthcare. So we know evidence from the King's Fund shows that if you live in a more deprived area, you're actually more likely to wait longer for treatment. So we know the waiting list is at about 7.6 million across the country, but you are pretty much twice as likely to wait longer if you live in a more deprived area than a very well-off area in England. People with lower incomes also, because of that, are considering going private, which is hitting their finances. Hospital data shows that the correlation between higher levels of, if you live in a deprived area, you're more likely to wait to access treatment because either wait times are poor or because you don't have the resources, whether it's taking the time off work or having the kind of phone credit to make appointments or to keep ringing the GP, which means when you actually do get treatment, you're sicker and you stay in hospital for longer. So there's a kind of access to treatment point. There's also the behaviours, healthy behaviours. So the kind of four biggest risk factors people talk about of like whether you have good or poor health are tobacco use, alcohol intake, whether you have a healthy diet, whether you do enough physical activity. And the evidence shows that in more deprived parts of the country, more people are likely to have more of these risk factors. And then the third one is the wider determinants, what people call the wider determinants of health, the kind of wonky phrase, which is more just about how many green spaces are available, activities for young people, are there more jobs in this area, is there better housing, clean air, do people have better kind of education around how to live a healthy life? And then that really just brings you down to the kind of impact of the cost of living. And the King's Fund have recently put out a report with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation about how poverty really does impact people's health, and you're more likely to be in ill health if you are poor.
And how much progress have we made towards kind of closing these gaps and improving things? Pre-2019, you know, pre the pandemic, the government seemed to be making a lot of positive noises around, you know, levelling up, whether that was through health or other things in the community, as well as solving things like social care and, you know, making, you know, record levels of investment in the NHS or hospitals. But did the pandemic delay that, or, you know, were we already starting to see a bit of a decline?
So I think you're right that you have to give the government and policymakers the benefit of the doubt that they did have ambitious plans, and the pandemic certainly kind of kiboshed those and took away a lot of government resource and a lot of money that might have been spent on other things and attention to address the pandemic. However, you've also got to look at the context of how the health service was and how the state of the nation was before the pandemic. And so, for example, waiting lists were at record highs before that. I think there are about 4 million people. It's a lot higher now, 7.6 million, but it was still, before the pandemic, higher than it had ever been. And I think that the reason for that is And whether you agree with the policy or not, based on your kind of economic preference, the decade before the pandemic of austerity did lead to levels of funding to the NHS that were under the average, the historical average over the time it's been around, and under what comparative European countries were paying. So there was the funding was increasing, but not by as much as other countries, and maybe not by as much to meet the demand of an aging population. And you have to add to that that before the pandemic, during those austerity years, local authorities were cut significantly, public health budgets were cut, social care budgets were cut, and really importantly, the NHS funding that went into the NHS was for day-to-day delivery of services and not long-term capital expenditure on technology or even buildings. And we hear about roofs falling in at the moment in hospitals. So it even before the pandemic, there were kind of short-term decisions over the long-term investment in the health service. I'd also say the post-pandemic, we know that it did cause a backlog of waiting lists. And I think it's really important to think about the kind of the trauma from the pandemic and the impact on staff. Because that, I think lots of people had very different experiences of the pandemic, you know, whether it was working from home versus, well, who knows what, but we know that NHS staff had an incredibly tough time. They were the people who had to move out of their family home because they didn't want them to get COVID. They were the people who had to hold the iPad up to the dying patient for the family to say goodbye. And I think everyone's moved on quite quickly from the impact that has on a workforce and the ability to kind of bounce back from that. And then when you add that into the fact that across the NHS, there's an average of 10% vacancy rate. So these NHS staff are working on shifts where there's not enough people there, and it is really, really tough for those people. So I think we have to respect that. And the recent NHS staff surveys showed that they feel kind of undervalued, overworked and unwell. A lot of them, I think 2 in 5 said they felt unwell from their working environment. So and then you've obviously got, after the pandemic, the economic impact of how much you can spend and the impact of the cost of living crisis on people's health. So it has had an impact, but really important that the health service was in a tricky place before it as well to recognise that fact.
And what are we looking at in terms of solutions, or at least some idea of, you know, the policy things that the next government can do to actually make an impact and, you know, make a difference to people's lives? What are the kind of things that it should be looking at? Is it just a case of, you know, throwing more money at the NHS to fix the problems, or are there other things that it can do?
Yeah, so on the kind of on the more money point, I think it's important to note that you don't always, even if an area is getting more money, it doesn't mean that people are able to access the services that money is providing. Maybe that's because they can't get an appointment. Maybe it's because they can't get time off work. Maybe it's because they don't have the money to catch the bus to go to the hospital appointment in time. It doesn't always have a direct correlation. I think at the King's Fund, we've been thinking, because there's not a lot of money around, as we know, in the economy. And there's three areas that we think would really make a big difference. The first is people have been talking for 10, 20, even 30 years about moving care closer to home. And it's a bit of a jargon, cliche phrase in the health world. But what that really means is that hospitals are under a huge amount of pressure at the minute. And some people think the kind of solution to that is build more hospitals, because they're all really full. But hospitals are the most expensive part of the health service to run there, and it's because treating the sickest people is the most expensive thing to do. So for example, an A&E appointment costs the health service between £200 and £400 versus a GP appointment costs the health service £50. So there is the kind of moving care closer to home is recognizing that there's loads of people who need regular contact with healthcare clinicians or nurses, like older people managing long-term conditions, but that can be done at home, or it can be done through primary and community or social care services that don't need to go to the hospital. And when they do go to the hospital, it's often that they'll stay there longer and they might even get more sick because they're there too long, they can't get out. So the next, like, whoever wins the election really needs to stop talking about moving care closer to home and really try and do it, even though it will be difficult because everything is very entrenched and hospitals are very important to the public as well as to physicians. The other thing that can be done is, we know that when I'm talking about tobacco use, alcohol use, physical activity, diet, there are just some really simple things that sometimes get tarnished with the kind of nanny state brush, which is really unhelpful, that can help people to kind of make healthier choices. Now, obviously, everyone has their own individual responsibility to make good, healthy choices. But there are just some simple things that at the time were called nanny state that I think, well, the polls do show today that past policies that have been called nanny state are actually, people see as common sense, the vast majority. So things like seatbelt laws, things like the smoking ban in public places, even the most recent, the Conservative government did the sugar tax on fizzy drinks. And when we look at what you could do to just kind of make small improvements to, like, the, for example, salt and sugar intake that children and adults are having, we know the public support greater restrictions and regulation around that. We know the public support regulations around advertising junk food to children. And so when you've got, I think, one third of kids leaving primary school obese, and when you've got an obesity crisis that's costing the NHS £6.5 billion a year, these kind of simple policy levers that don't actually cost money for the government, and that lots of people say, oh, industry don't like them. But when you talk to supermarkets, they actually say the government need to regulate, because if we can't take action ourselves, because then we lose the competitive advantage. So there is actually a swelling of opinion from even industry that says, if you do this as one, for example, trying to reduce, you know, buy one, get one free deals on all the sweet products, maybe you could do it on, like, vegetables, although that would take a cultural reset. Like, supermarkets are not against that if you just make it a level playing field. So there are some things that sometimes get tarnished with the nanny state brush that you can really do to intervene.
That's all for this week's episode. If you enjoyed what you heard, then you can subscribe to the Yorkshire Post for more exclusive interviews and analysis from me this weekend. Next week, I'm in another safe seat, but this time in North Yorkshire. I'll be in the Conservative safe seat of Thirsk and Malton, where I'll be asking whether rural communities are turning their backs on the Tories. And if so, will it be enough to cause a major upset in one of their heartlands? See you there.